This is 1988 Tops, where every card has a story to tell. Your hosts are David McKellis and Matt Kuzma. Let's play ball. Welcome back to 1988 Tops. David, what's our card for this week?
Our card this week is Donnie Moore, pitcher for the California Angels, card number 471.
Before we get to Donnie, we have some follow-up, and that is to say thanks to old friends and new friends that we saw at the Sabre Convention in Chicago last week.
Matt, it has been a rough month for me, but this past week was excellent. I was able to see multiple friends of the pod in person, people who we've never met before, including past guests Adam Dorowski, Mark Simon. I even saw RBI correspondent Brian in person this past week. So it's been a very good week. We also saw John Racanelli, who wrote the Bob Dernier Sabre bio and runs the Sabre Landmark Project. And I got to tour Wrigley Field with the official historian of the Chicago Cubs. It was a really good week. Great to see a lot of fellow Sabre members in Chicago. I know that we missed a couple. And folks, if you are in Chicago, let us know. We will buy you a pizza and a beer.
That is a promise. And one of the people that we got to share pizza and beer with was, as you mentioned, Adam Dorowski. Adam Dorowski and Sports Reference have announced big news this week that they have purchased the Immaculate Grid, the game that is sweeping the world in baseball trivia. This is as big a deal as when the New York Times bought the Wordle, bringing it to their app every day. It is now a habit that my wife and I take part in every single day. Surely the Immaculate Grid is not far behind in terms of worldwide domination. Immaculate Grid is a trivia type of game where you fill in the names of players based on different characteristics that they share in common with other players. Generally, it is players that played for two different teams and other attributes, say like 300 game winners or 300 strikeout pitchers. The more obscure the player that you use, the better rarity score you might get.
I have used in the past week Don Sutton, Ron Kittle. I used Eric Davis, so less rare, but you can basically like any of these journeymen. And particularly the ones who didn't play in a lot of games. Somebody pointed out to me that Julio Franco played for the Tampa Bay Rays, and they learned that from our podcast, a fact that I had totally forgotten. He played one game for Tampa Bay. I was lamenting that I can never remember Tampa Bay Rays or Arizona Diamondbacks.
Those aren't real cities and states. They're not real teams.
They're not teams that we recognize on this podcast.
Folks, you just use Jack Lazorco any chance you can. You're guaranteed to win. So thank you again to everyone that we saw and to everyone at the Sabre Convention. We're glad that you had a good time in our fair city. And now it's time for this week's card and Donnie Moore. And why are we talking about Donnie today?
We recently tested out Spotify's Ask a Question. And our question was, anybody you want us to talk about? And we got a response from listener, longtime friend of the show, Aaron. And he requested a difficult card, and that's Donnie Moore. And Donnie Moore has to come with the content warning about domestic violence, alcoholism, and suicide. Donnie Moore died by suicide and shot and tried to kill his wife, Tanya, before turning the gun on himself. And there's no sugarcoating that part. Donnie Moore was not a good guy. There's going to be a few of these that we have talked about what to do with Mel Hall, with Luis Polonia, with Donnie Moore. And if we're going to cover all the cards, some of them are going to be less fun, and we're going to know it going in. And Donnie Moore plays an important role in 80s baseball, as he gave up a home run in the 1986 ALCS that helped lead the Boston Red Sox to the World Series. And some people blame that pitch and that home run for his death. But that's not the whole story, and it's much more complicated. And Donnie Moore had a real dark side. He had a drinking problem and was abusive and controlling throughout his marriage. And it's not going to be an easy one. There's no Sabre bio, probably because this isn't a fun one to write or really learn about. But there are a bunch of great articles that talk about the story and also tell Tanya's story. And Michael McKnight from Sports Illustrated wrote one of those. We'll rely heavily on that story and some of the interviews. And there are also some stories from closer to the time of Donnie's death that help tell the story.
And just a reminder for listeners, we do talk about every card. We're talking about the people on them. We're talking about the card itself. We'll talk about all of those things. And talking about them doesn't endorse anyone's behavior, but it's just a chance for us to reflect on the cards and the people and everything that surrounded them. So let's go to the front of 471. And we have what is objectively a really good-looking card. We've got Donnie Moore. You'd say he's in the dugout. But you don't really know. He's just in front of a dark painted brick wall, wearing the most beautiful California Angels satin jacket you've ever seen, wearing a big hat. He's got an excellent mustache, and it's a candid shot. It just looks like maybe he's listening to someone talking. It's an excellent looking card.
It's a strange lighting because of the dark background behind him, but you can see a shadow. It does look like it could be nighttime. It really could be any time of day. Like he's just sitting in this dark brick-walled room. It's a good outfit. I do really like that jacket.
Now let's go to the back of 471. We have Donnie Moore, pitcher, 6'1", 185, right-handed thrower and left-handed batter. Signed by the Cubs as a free agent in 1973 and drafted January 24th, 1985. We will get to that. Born February 13th, 1954 in Lubbock, Texas, with a home in Anaheim, California.
Lubbock, Texas, home of Texas Tech University, the 10th most populous city in Texas with over 250,000 people. When Donnie was born, it was going through a boom, growing from 70,000 to 130,000 in the 1950s. And Matt, I have a note here that you were the sports reporter, Cub reporter for the Bears.
That's correct. I was covering the Baylor versus Texas Tech football game, October 3rd, 1998. It was my first time to Lubbock, Texas. And it's not a scenic town. It is cotton fields as far as the eye can see. Cotton fields and tumbleweeds is pretty much all I ever saw there. And the football wasn't very good either as far as my alma mater was concerned. A string of a couple two-point losses that we suffered through. At that point, Baylor and Texas Tech were in the Big 12 Conference. My freshman year, they were in the Southwest Conference. I put a link in here, and we can have this in the show notes. This goes to the game story that I wrote from Lubbock and also has a column in that issue of me complaining about the on-campus shuttle service and calling the trolley that would ride around campus and the apartment buildings around, calling it the death ride.
Also, Matt, are you receiving any royalties from these articles as we're linking to this?
If you go to page 6 of the 6-page paper, if you wanted to use any of the ads or coupons on the back there, I think I do get some royalties.
Along with being the site of Matt Kuzma sports history, Lubbock, Texas, also home of Buddy Holly. And the city has a Buddy Holly Center for Performing Arts, which opened in 2021. Also home to other musicians, Delbert McClinton, Natalie Maines of the Chicks, as well as her dad, Lloyd Maines, and Amanda Shires of the 400 Unit and the High Women. In Lubbock, Donnie's father, Conway, was a truck driver, and his mother, Willie, was a housekeeper. Donnie went to Monterey High School, and he was so focused on baseball, even as a youth, his goal was to be a major leaguer. Prior to high school, he was given this opportunity to transfer into Monterey. He was from East Lubbock, and when he went to this other high school at Monterey, it was in a different part of town, and his friends and classmates called him a traitor. But Donnie knew that Bobby Mogul, who was the winningest coach in Texas history, would help him get noticed and help him get drafted. Monterey High School opened in 1955 as a white-only high school, and according to one article, it was mostly populated by the children of Lubbock's doctors and lawyers. Donnie, when he went there, was the only black student and the only one who didn't wear cowboy boots. In a 1990 article, it said that Donnie remained the only black player to ever wear the Monterey uniform at that point. Famous alumni include Glenna Goodacre, who designed the Vietnam Women's Memorial in Washington, D.C., and also the Sacagawea Dollar. Her daughter, Jill, was a model and actress and is married to Harry Connick Jr. Another alum, famous defender or not really of Michael Jordan in the 1989 NBA playoffs, Craig Elo, 1988 gold medalist in women's basketball and Women's Basketball Hall of Famer, Cammie Etheridge, and country musician who toured with The Clash and also sang the Spanish background vocals on Should I Stay or Should I Go, Joe Ely, as well as the actor who portrayed Maynard, the pawn shop owner in Pulp Fiction, Dwayne Whitaker. In high school, Donnie led Monterey to the state tournament 3 straight years. He pitched and hit third. He had a good fastball and a curveball, and he wasn't afraid to throw up and in on opposing batters. As a senior, he won 18 games, striking out 222 in 132 innings, totally dominant, and when he wasn't pitching, he hit 400 while playing the outfield. He pitched every chance he could because he wanted to show off if scouts were there. He once pitched in 9 straight playoff games. He won the state semifinal game, and in the final, he was brought in to close the game. Up 2-1, he gave up a hit, got an out, and then walked the next 2 batters. So with the bases loaded, he calls his coach to pull him, saying he was too nervous. His coach had been dealing with a catcher who had been hit in the face with a ball and was bleeding out of his nose, and so he left Donnie in. He struck out the next 2 batters to win the game and win the state title. So Donnie, even though he was the only black student at his high school, was also one of the most popular students at his high school because of this athletic prowess. And while still in high school, he started a relationship with a girl named Tanya. And they started dating at 16. And when he was 17, Tanya gave birth to a daughter named Demetria. And Demetria would live with Donnie's parents for 6 years while Donnie established himself in baseball. At 18, Tanya and Donnie got married in secret. The only family member present was Demetria, who was at that point 1.5 years old.
In the 1972 draft, the Red Sox selected Donnie in the 12th round right out of high school as an outfielder. And the University of Texas was also recruiting him as an outfielder, but he wanted to pitch. So he turned down those offers and went instead to Ranger Junior College, which is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, about a couple hundred miles from Lubbock. Jim Morris, subject of The Rookie, who we discussed in the Mark Chardy episode, played for Ranger Junior College as well. Ellis Burks is another Ranger player in the 1988 set. Donnie went there and proved that he could pitch. He won 18 games and led Ranger to the National Junior College World Series, where he had a great tournament, pitched a shutout in the tournament semifinal. And after the game, Ranger coach Jack Allen gathered his players to decide who would pitch the next night.
Donnie volunteered. As we know from his high school experience, he wanted to pitch every day. When he stood up, coach said, "You pitch tonight, and you've already pitched in every ball game we've had here." Donnie said, "You've got an option. You can pitch me or fight me." His coach said, "I'm not about to fight you." The next night, Donnie pitched a 2-hit shutout to win the national title.
After that one season, the Cubs selected Donnie in the January draft with their first pick. That's an error because the card said the Cubs signed him as a free agent. We will notify the Topps Corporation to rectify this. He was selected 3rd right after the Texas Rangers selected Jim Sundberg out of Iowa. And Donnie and Tanya left Demetria with Donnie's parents and left for Bradenton, Florida.
In the minors, Tanya would put on a catcher's mitt and catch Donnie's pitches when there was no catcher available. She helped him throughout his career until he learned the split finger, and then she gave up on trying to catch Donnie's pitches. Donnie worked his way quickly through the minors, but then would bounce back and forth between AAA and the majors for nearly 10 years before finding a regular spot in a bullpen. The first year, he pitched only 10 innings in 4 games. 1974, he moved up to A-ball in Key West, went 11-12, but had a very good 2.79 ERA. Moved up to AA at Midland, so he's back in Texas, but he struggled at first with an ERA near 7 in 22 innings. He stayed at AA for 1975 and was much better. In 28 games, he had a 2.97 ERA and a 14-8 record.
Which leads to a fun fact on the bottom of the card that Donnie tied for the Texas League lead with 3 shutouts in 1975.
In 1974 and 75, Donnie and his teammate, Bruce Sutter, both learned the split finger from their pitching coach, Fred Martin. An interesting side note on Fred Martin, he pitched well into his 40s in the minor leagues and had a stint with the Cardinals briefly in 1946. But in the 1940s, he signed with a team in Mexico as a protest against low pay and a lack of competitive market and competitive free agency in the United States. For that challenge to major league monopoly, he was banned from baseball briefly. And after Martin and another player filed a lawsuit, the ban was reduced, but he became known as one of the earliest proponents of the split finger fastball. Bruce Sutter would thank both Fred Martin and Donnie Moore in his Hall of Fame speech. According to Mike Kruko, the best at it besides Bruce Sutter is Donnie Moore, but he threw it so much harder. Donnie was recognized early on for having a very good split finger pitch. He just had to learn how to control it. Like Bruce Sutter, this pitch would lead to injuries later in his career. But this year, it earned him a call-up to the big leagues after that great season. He pitched only 8 innings for the Cubs, but he had a taste of the big leagues.
He wouldn't make it back there until 1977. He played 1976 and some of 1977 in Wichita, and his numbers weren't really great in AAA, an ERA near 5. He was being used as a starter at that time. He didn't have as dramatic as an ascent to the majors as Bruce Sutter did. But he was called up in 1977 by the Cubs and closed the season out with the big league team as a reliever, appearing in 27 games. He had a 4.07 ERA, which was a 109 ERA plus. That was good enough to make the squad in 1978, spending all of the year with the Cubs. As Bruce Sutter's setup man, he appeared in 71 games, getting a lot of work, 102 innings, a 9-7 record, 4.12 ERA, which was right around league average.
1979, he started okay, but then he fell apart in May and June. He gave up 30 earned runs and 31 innings over 15 games. And that included Donnie's part in the ridiculous 23-22 game between the Cubs and Phillies. Donnie gave up 7 of the Phillies' runs. He improved in July, but he was no longer the setup man, and his numbers suffered. He spent some time back in AAA, and after the season, the Cubs were looking to trade him. So they sent him to St. Louis for Mike Tyson. Not that one. Different one. This was not a heavy hitter. This was a guy who hit 226 in 2 seasons for the Cubs and then was out of baseball. Donnie's time in St. Louis wasn't much better. He had an ERA over 6 in 11 games, was sent to AAA at Springfield, Illinois, and was better at AAA. And so he's invited to spring training 1981 as a non-roster invitee.
But 1981 spring training would be very eventful for Donnie. He was assigned to minor league camp. And 4 days later, he was involved in a serious car accident. At 2 a.m. on April 11th, Donnie was driving a 1981 Mustang at what reports called a high rate of speed. The car jumped a curb and rode up an incline to a railroad track, is how the Tampa Tribune reported it. The car became airborne, flipped several times, and landed upside down atop several junk cars in a vacant lot, is how the St. Petersburg Times reported it. And a police spokesman told the Tampa Tribune, the car soared 152 feet before landing.
This sounds like something from Grand Theft Auto. It is an outrageous story, and it led to his passenger, Donald Harvey, being thrown from the car and dying at the scene of the accident. Donnie suffered lacerations and internal injuries and was charged with 1 count of manslaughter. He entered a plea of no contest and was placed on probation. Reading this article, I found this on Retro Simba, which is a St. Louis Cardinals history website. And this article was called Donnie Moore, Stint with the Cardinals, Tainted by Tragedy. I raise this only because it's both troubling that this happened, but also that this was not reported in any of the other articles. This wasn't in this long-form Sports Illustrated article that outlines most of Donnie's life. He killed somebody and pled no contest. He was given probation for that. I would speculate that driving at that time, at that speed, there may have been alcohol involved. And this is one of many red flags and something that nowadays probably would be addressed, or more likely, Donnie would spend a significant amount of time in jail and be involved in a wrongful death lawsuit. I just can't imagine his career going on in the same way after an incident like this. It was really shocking to not find that in some of these big articles that were written even many years later, where they were combing through a lot of different sources.
So instead of going to jail, he went back to Springfield and AAA and pitched well with an 8-6 record and 3.42 ERA. But that was the end of his time in St. Louis. He was sent to Milwaukee for cash in September of 1981. But only played 3 games for the Brewers. They returned him to the Cardinals 2 months later without telling us why, Whitey Herzog said. What?
I found nothing else on this.
The line on the card for the 81 Brewers is 3 games, 4 innings pitched, 3 earned runs, 2 strikeouts, 4 walks, 6.75 ERA, and then sent back to the Cardinals.
According to Baseball Reference, it just says returned to the St. Louis Cardinals by the Milwaukee Brewers following previous purchase. It is like if you bought an extra copy of Grand Theft Auto 3 for PlayStation 2 and you needed to return it to Target. They returned Donnie Moore from the Milwaukee Brewers to the St. Louis Cardinals without any explanation. You know, no explanation needed as long as you have a receipt. But in the offseason, St. Louis trades Donnie to Atlanta for a AAA pitcher, Dan Moragiello, pretty good name. And Donnie spent 1982 and 83 splitting time between Atlanta and Richmond, pitched in 16 games in 82. He did pitch in the playoffs, 2.2 scoreless innings against his former team, the Cardinals. And in 83, he's 29 years old, finally starting to look comfortable at the major leagues. He played only 12 games at AAA that season, 43 with Atlanta, had an ERA plus over 100 for the first time since 1977, saved 6 games. The Sporting News pointed out that Moore now uses a split-fingered changeup that leaves hitters flat-footed. He no longer tries to break a bat with every pitch.
In 1984, Joe Torre made him the closer of the Braves. Torre said Moore would put on a face to intimidate batters, and he still wasn't afraid to go after hitters. In the notorious 1984 brawl between the Braves and the Padres that we've talked about, I don't even know how many times on this podcast, Torre brought Donnie Moore in the 9th inning when the Braves were up 5-1, and Torre told him to get an out. Moore immediately hit Greg Nettles, setting off another round of fisticuffs. But overall, Moore was very effective as a closer. That season, he saved 16 games. He had a 2.94 ERA in 64 innings, and a 132 ERA plus, which was his career best.
But in the offseason, the Braves left Donnie unprotected in the free agent compensation draft. The Angels got to pick in this free agent compensation draft because they had lost Fred Lynn to free agency. And Matt, you pointed out that he was acquired via draft, which we normally don't see for a guy 12 years after he initially signs out of community college. But that's why it says he was picked in the draft, almost like an expansion draft. The free agent compensation draft allowed teams to pick up players who were left unprotected. Gene Mauch told Donnie that he would be the closer for the Angels and that he would work with veteran Bob Boone as his catcher. And the two worked really well together. Donnie worried less about what he was going to throw. He depended on Boone's pitch calling, and Donnie could focus on location and quality of pitches. And Bob Boone said, as the situation got tougher, his ability to make the pitch got better. If the bases are loaded and the game is on the line, there's not many people I can ask to throw a split-finger fastball, the toughest pitch to control, but I would do that routinely with Donnie.
And Donnie always wanted the ball, and Mauch gave it to him. He had the best season of his career in 1985 and one of the best relief seasons in the 1980s. He appeared in 65 games and saved what was then a record for the Angels with 31 games, a 1.92 ERA in 103 innings, was a 2.17 ERA plus. His season performance was valued at 3.6 WAR, which was the 27th best relief performance in the whole of the 1980s, making him the Angels' only All-Star in 1985. And he pitched 2 perfect innings in the All-Star game as well. By the end of the season, the Angels were challenging the Royals down to the wire for the AL West. They won 90 games, but fell just 1 game short. Donnie, meanwhile, was named the team's MVP for 1985, and he was rewarded for his performance with a 3-year deal worth $3 million.
With that new cash, Donnie and Tanya bought an $850,000 home with a pool and a lake in a prestigious neighborhood, and Donnie stocked the lake with catfish, and they had what seemed like a perfect life. In 1986, Donnie opened the season with a blown save on opening day. By the end of May, his ERA was up over 5, and he was in a lot of pain. It started in spring training when he had a stabbing pain in his lower back. His pain radiated out from that pain in his lower back. He missed most of June, but was outstanding from July 7th through the end of the season. And the way that he was still pitching was getting regular cortisone treatment to relieve the pain and inflammation in his back and shoulder. It was believed that he had around 12 cortisone shots during the 1986 season. I looked this up on the Mayo Clinic's website, and it said in general, you shouldn't get cortisone injections more than once every 6 weeks, and usually not more than 3 or 4 times a year. Donnie was basically being held together with cortisone shots, and he was able to put together a really great streak. After July 7th, in 34 games, he had a 2.22 ERA in 52 innings, almost living up to the season prior where he was just outstanding. And the Angels were 27-7 in those 34 games. They won the AL West by 5 games over the surprising Texas Rangers. Donnie had 21 saves, overall a 2.97 ERA, a 1.39 ERA plus. But those solid numbers just really papered over the pain and injury that he was feeling and the fact that his career was nearly over at this point.
In the ALCS, the Angels faced the Red Sox in 1986. The team split the first 2 games at Fenway. In Game 3, Donnie came in the 8th inning, up 4-1, looking for a 2-inning save. He gave up a couple hits, balked in a run, allowed another run to make it 4-3. But his teammates gave him an insurance run in the bottom of the 8th, and he closed the game out, albeit a little shaky. Game 4, the Angels won in extra innings. Then in Game 5, the Angels were up 3-1. They took a 5-2 lead into the 9th inning at home.
In the 9th inning, the police had filed into the bullpen to take the field after the Angels inevitably win the American League title. Gary Pettis had already been named the ALCS MVP, but starter Mike Witt is still in the game. He gives up a single, strikes out Jim Rice, and then Don Baylor hits a home run to bring the Red Sox within 1 run. Mike Witt gets another out, so 2 outs in the 9th, and he's pulled for Gary Lucas, who hits Rich Gedman. So with 2 outs, a man on first, they pull the lefty Lucas and bring in Donnie to face right-handed Dave Henderson. In his career to that point, Dave Henderson was 1-for-3 against Donnie with a home run. But that season, with Boston, Henderson had hit only 196 with 1 home run. So Donnie gets 2 strikes using his fastball. In the dugout, Reggie Jackson is folding up his hat, taking off his glasses. The team is ready to celebrate. 2 strikes. The crowd is, you can feel it. Henderson takes a couple balls, fouls off a split finger. Boone calls a fastball, fouled off again. At this point, Bob Boone is afraid that Henderson has the timing of the fastball, so he calls for another splitter. And then this happens.
To left field and deep.
An unbelievable turn of events down to the final strike. Now the Red Sox are up 6-5, but this game's not over.
Bottom of the 9th, the Angels tie the game. They even loaded the bases with 1 out. They had a chance to bail Donnie out, but Doug DeCensus and Bobby Grich couldn't get the winning run home against pitcher Steve Crawford. In extra innings, Donnie is still in the game.
What?
The Angels had used 5 pitchers the night before. So they didn't have much choice of who to bring in, so they just left him in. And he got into and out of a first and third jam in the 10th, remains in the 11th, opens the 11th. Of course, he hits Don Baylor.
Well, of course. I mean, naturally.
Don Baylor ends up on third and scores on a sacrifice fly. And after the game, despite the other failures and mistakes that preceded the home run, Donnie is the center of attention. And he took the brunt of the blame from the media and the fans. He said, maybe if I tried to blow it past him, we'd be drinking champagne now. He said, it hurts so much, but only so much. I can't let it get to me. I'm not going to let it get to me. And much later, when asked about it, Bob Boone would say, the fact is, he didn't throw a very good pitch. I know in my heart, if it had been a good one, his good one, Henderson wouldn't have gotten the hit. He would have struck him out. It was the right pitch call, but Donnie just didn't throw his best split finger. But it's important to remember here, this is Game 5. The Angels had 2 more chances to win the World Series, but as we've seen so often, that one pivotal moment can just break a team. And to go from 1 strike away from a win, you just knew that they weren't going to pull it out. They lost Game 6, 10-4, and Game 7, 8-1. Donnie did appear in Game 7 and pitched a scoreless eighth inning, but the series was over.
This is incredibly unfair to Donnie Moore, the player, in 1986, to be blamed with the failure of the team because of giving up a home run. We see over and over in baseball and in all sports what looks like momentum and inevitability change back, and teams win or lose all the time in all different situations. And the thought of giving up that one home run when we were one pitch away from winning doesn't make any sense if it's also followed with, oh yeah, they also blew the chance to win the game in the 10th and 11th innings and in game 6 and in game 7. So I think it's just very unfair.
The fans were relentless. They did not forgive him. Donnie maybe didn't forgive himself. And if it had just been a home run and Donnie hadn't had so many other problems, maybe it would have been something that he could get over.
Well, in the end, the Red Sox won the ALCS, but did not win the World Series that year. As a consolation prize, the Angels did, however, receive a spot in RBI baseball. And thus, and that takes us to the RBI corner with Brian. And we are back in the RBI corner. Brian, welcome back. And we're here to talk about the Angels.
Great to be back. The Angels we discussed in the Brian Downing, Don Sutton, and George Hendrick episodes. And I have to admit that I accidentally and reflexively started researching the Angels and preparing for the Don Baylor episode before realizing that he's actually on Boston in RBI baseball. As we've covered before, the California Angels are one of the top three regular teams in the game, along with Boston and Detroit. They have great power up and down the lineup and just an absolute superstar in Reggie Jackson. As we talked about previously, they have 10 guys who would have the second most power on the Astros or the third most power on the Cardinals, so that they're just loaded up with power. They have great balance, too. They start 3 lefties and 5 righties, have 2 good lefties off the bench. But, of course, Donnie Moore is a pitcher, and this is the Donnie Moore episode. So how is the California Angels pitching? Well, the pitching has unusual endurance and more finesse than velocity, particularly with Don Sutton and Mike Witt, the two starters. Both Sutton and Mike Witt are tied with the two Astros starters, those being Mike Scott and Nolan Ryan, for the most endurance in the game, and they have 25% more endurance than the average starters. This is kind of odd because for the Astros, you would understand why the starters can go so long in the games because the hitting isn't very good. But the Angels have a very good offense, so it seems odd that the game would feel the need to subsidize the Angels' pitchers as it does with the Astros. Nevertheless, none of those pitchers have the same endurance as 1988 Topps legend Burt Blyleven. Now, finesse usually plays better than velocity, so you can dominate with either starter in the Angels' lineup. The staff is all righties, though, so you don't have someone to handle a lefty-heavy lineup. So if you're playing a team like Detroit that has a lot of lefties, you're going to have to pitch against them with righties. That pitching staff is also very Don-heavy, with both a Donald in Don Sutton and a Donnie in Donnie Moore, as Donnie is apparently his given name, at least if Wikipedia is to be believed.
So how about Donnie Moore as the player?
So Donnie Moore is one of the two relievers on the Angels, and he's probably the less effective reliever. The other reliever is Doug Corbett. He's the hardest thrower on the Angels, but he's only tied for 16th in the game across 40 pitchers, so it's probably better to say that velocity isn't a weakness of Donnie Moore's. But his inability to curve pitches is a major weakness. His combined curve left and curve right is tied for last in the game, and the guys that he's tied for last with all throw harder too, especially another 1988 Topps legend, that being Juan Berenguer. Donnie also lacks any other standout attributes. He has a very weak drop ball or changeup. He has a very standard reliever endurance. So he's maybe not the best option if you're playing with the Angels.
So do you ever play him?
He's probably just the Angels' break glass in case of emergency guy. If you're playing a series and you don't need to save your starters, so if you're just playing one game and you can use with both of your starters, you're probably pitching both Mike Witt and Don Sutton for the entire game, given both their quality and their endurance. But even if you're playing a series, you're probably only bringing Donnie Moore in behind Doug Corbett. Now, the dnee.com website that we covered in the Don Baylor episode says that you should start Donnie Moore, because he's fine as a starter, but he'll be a powder keg as a reliever. That's a bit apocryphal, though, and while I enjoy the entertainment of the apocryphal narratives, I would not put my money down on starting Donnie Moore. I would just bring him in off the bench. And unless your strategy is only to pitch with guys named Don, which, hey, we all try to handicap ourselves in different ways and make the game more fun, I'd play it straight, ride your starters and play with the California Angels, and only bring Donnie Moore in as your fourth guy.
Well, you know, my Garth-based lineups never seem to work, so this actually sounds like pretty good advice. Thanks, Brian. And we're back. In 1987, the very first thing that he was asked about in spring training was that pitch.
And Donnie said, more than likely, I'll think about that until the day I die. Angels fans didn't let him forget it. They booed him every time that he pitched. His numbers on the back of his card in 1987 looked good. He was 2-2 with 2.7 ERA, 163 ERA plus, but he only pitched in 14 games. He was booed by his home fans, and on top of the booing, Donnie was injured. He said after a loss to reporters, I'm sick of it. I don't mind being booed, but I've been hurt. Let someone else go out there who's healthy. I can't go on this way. It's as simple as that. Something has to be done. Some more shots, something. His ribs, shoulder, and back hurt. He missed time in June, and even the Angels GM started publicly criticizing him, saying, instead of whining about his rib cage, he should have been out there earning his money. What do we pay him $1 million for? It turned out he had a bone spur on his spine, and he underwent back surgery. But the team and fans weren't sympathetic. He didn't get an apology. And in 1988, he was back, but he just wasn't the same as his 1985 self. The first four times he appeared, he blew leads in the opponent's final at bat. On the year, he's 5-2 with four saves and a 4.91 ERA. And on August 26th, he got cut. That fall, he went hunting with his friend and fellow scapegoat, Bill Buckner. They had been friends since they were playing for the Cubs, and now they were both notorious for their mistakes. Buckner was with Kansas City, as was Bob Boone. And so in 1989, Kansas City, on Bob Boone's recommendation, gives Donnie a chance. They send him to AAA, and in a twist, his teammate is Steve Crawford, who was the winning pitcher in Game 5 of the 1986 ALCS, and they became friends as well.
But Donnie lost speed, and every pitch hurt. He pitched in seven games for Omaha with a 6.39 ERA in 12 innings, and in June he was cut, and that was the end of Donnie's career. So closing the book on Donnie Moore, 13 seasons in the major leagues, record of 43 wins and 40 losses, 89 saves, an ERA of 3.67, which is a 111 ERA plus. 1 month after he was cut from Omaha, Donnie Moore shot his wife, Tanya, three times and shot himself.
On July 18th, 1989, Donnie died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He was 35. In the news, his unraveling and his death would be blamed on that pitch. But it wasn't just that one pitch that led Donnie down this path to suicide. And so we should back up. Donnie and Tanya Moore had been together since they were teenagers, but Donnie was in secret, controlling and abusive. The first time he beat her was when they were 19 years old. At that point, they were already parents. They were already married. But Tanya stayed with him and helped him in his career. Donnie controlled Tanya in other ways, too. She could spend all the money that she wanted, but clothes had to fit Donnie's specifications. Dresses, shorts couldn't be too short. Men were supposed to call her Mrs. Moore, never her first name. But she and Donnie were the only ones who knew this rule, and she would be punished if it was broken. He hit Tanya throughout their marriage, but he kept it hidden, never hitting her face. We talked about George Hendrick in his episode and how misunderstood George Hendrick was. He was the only teammate who ever confronted Donnie about the bruises. While he didn't talk to the press, he later confirmed the accounts of two other Angels players who remembered Hendrick confronting Donnie and saying, "You want to hit somebody?" implying, "Come at me, stay away from your wife." But generally, the years of abuse and Donnie's drinking were hidden. The Moores presented outwardly as a perfect couple, high school sweethearts. They had three kids. Tanya was interviewed by Cosmopolitan for an interview called Secrets to a Successful Marriage. Donnie had some friends, but no real close friends that he would talk with other than Tanya. And he also was known to drink heavily. After that ALCS Game 5 loss, he was inconsolable. He drank, and Tanya said that she sent her mother to her room and said, "Mama, no matter what you hear, do not come out of this room." No one really knows what happened in this house because they kept it secret and kept it close. And Donnie's mood could change quickly and violently. When he was cut by the Royals, he came back to California, and Tanya decided it was over for her as well. She knew if he didn't have baseball and wasn't away, that things could be dangerous for her. So she moved out. At this point, his career is over, and he knows it. His marriage is falling apart, and he was having money problems. While Tanya was separated, she still came back to the family house, did laundry, visited with Donnie. He knew that he couldn't afford that home that they bought. He hadn't been able to make mortgage payments using the money that he had made in Omaha. He owed money to his agent. And now even that meager AAA salary was gone. The night before he killed himself, he called Reggie Jackson to ask to borrow money. And Reggie said no. They had been friends, but he couldn't go there. On July 18th, Donnie called Tanya to come to the house. At this point, their daughter, Demetria, was old enough to drive. She drove with a friend, and when they got to the house, Tanya went in, and Donnie sent Demetria to the store. An argument ensued about money or any number of things. And when that argument reached a certain point, Tanya called Demetria, called the car phone, and told her to come back. Donnie had set out some memorabilia on the bed, some game balls, baseball cards, and a paper with a list of Bible verses, and he grabbed his gun. He pointed it at himself with his two sons present and his wife. And Tanya said, "Really? You're going to shoot yourself in front of your kids?" And so instead, he pointed at his wife and shot her three times, hitting her in the neck and twice in the upper torso. She made it out of the house. She ran. Demetria arrived in time to get her mother and take her to the hospital, where she spent months in recovery and was able to be released. But as the car was driving to the hospital, there was one final shot. Demetria saw her brother, Ronnie, run out of the house and collapse to the ground in anguish that he had just watched his father shoot himself in the head. In the years since, Tanya has been open about the abuse that she experienced and also the way that she was treated afterwards. Donnie's family were grieving and blamed her. They blamed her background. Her mother had run a bar, had multiple men. She must be at fault. There were claims that it was another man who shot Donnie. And these are things that police found no evidence of. Tanya said, "People asked me, why didn't you leave him?" And she said, "First of all, he told me he would find me and kill me the moment I left." She said, "And look at how I grew up. My mama had eight men. I wanted my kids to have one man." But she also had fond memories because they were high school sweethearts. She said, "He was a very sweet guy. I loved Donnie very much, and he loved me very, very much. He didn't quite know how to show it." But she also said Donnie was the kind of guy, if he couldn't have me, no one was going to have me. Despite what happened and what he had done to her and all of the years of abuse, in the hospital, Tanya asked to see her husband. And they wheeled Donnie's body in so that she could say a final goodbye to him. And she said goodbye and forgave him and asked him why. And that's the question I think a lot of people asked. And I think there are a lot of people who think that this was a straight line. That you have a guy who couldn't deal with the failure of that 1986 pitch, with that experience in the 1986 ALCS, and it's point A, point B, done. Gary Lucas was the pitcher right before Donnie, and he said, "I'm the guy who should have taken the brunt for everything that happened afterwards because I could have kept Donnie out of that game." Brian Downing blamed the media and said, "You destroyed a man's life over one pitch. You buried the guy. He wasn't given credit for all the good things he did." But for Donnie Moore, it wasn't just that one pitch. This was a culmination of things. For a narrative, it's so easy for us as sports fans to think that the game is the most important thing. And this is a slow burn of a really troubled person. Donnie Moore's life was not just that one pitch. Dave Henderson was not responsible for Donnie's death. A lot of things happened prior to that home run. And a lot of things happened that led up to Donnie's death. Interventions were missed. Points of inflection, red flags were missed. And he was a troubled and depressed man who realized that he couldn't paper over the problems with money anymore. He was sitting in a house that he couldn't afford with a marriage that was falling apart and that he could no longer control.
It's a very hard story and a very sad one for so many reasons. Thank you very much, David, for putting that together today. And thank you to you at home. If you or someone you know needs help, please call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. On Twitter, we are at Tops1988. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.